So I'm happy and wonderful. Okay. I'm going to be introducing Sarah Durham, who's the principal and founder of Big Duck. Sarah grew up in the advertising, design, and marketing worlds. In 1994, it was time for her to put communications best practices to work for a better reason, to help nonprofits increase their visibility, raise money, and move the needle on their missions. So she made her escape and started Big Duck. And today, Big Duck is the leading communications firm that works exclusively with nonprofits. Clients include local, regional, national, and international organizations. Sarah is a total nonprofit communications nerd. I don't know if we would have pegged you as that when you walked in the room, but we'll hear what you say about that today. She was named a top fundraiser under 40 by Fundraising Success Magazine in 2006, and one of the most influential women in technology by Fast Company Magazine in 2010. She's a regular speaker at Association of Fundraising Professionals and Nonprofit Technology Network conferences. She's the author of Brand Raising, How Nonprofits Raise Visibility and Money Through Smart Communications. Sarah teaches aspiring nonprofit communications nerds, your people, at NYU's Wagner School and at the Athena Center for Women's Leadership at Barnard College. She regularly gives workshops and webinars to anyone who will listen, and she tweets at Big Duck Sarah. Please, so you can join her in conversation there. So we welcome you.
And I'm going to have books for sale after this.
Yes. Books for sale after this. And I'm going to go sit down there so I can watch your presentation.
So I have this right now. Are you doing okay? You're good?
Okay. I'm not a fan of the podium, so we'll see if the technology works with me.
You need to fundraise. You need to make your programs work, whether those are membership-based programs, like building your foundation, or getting people to come to an education program. And you might do some advocacy work, either locally in your community or on a national or legislative level. That's a lot of communicating, and that's actually a much more complex way of communicating than if you were, for instance, Target. You know, Target, if they sell a product to a customer and the customer buys the product, they've largely been effective. But most of us in our professional lives have a lot of different constituents we have to deal with. And that brings up a whole other level of sophistication around communications. So what often happens, I find, is that when we meet people, or when I meet people and I say, oh, you know, tell me who you are, what do? Give me the elevator pitch. I hear a lot of things like, you know, I'm Frank, I'm the CEO of the XYZ PDQ Foundation, acronym. And of course, you know, we care about seals, and so we do blah. And actually, in that snippet, there's almost a lot more questions left for me as a listener than answers given, information given. And the reason that is that we tend to be so close to the work we do that we forget the person we're talking to. first time that we've been having for 25 years. And one of the big perils is losing because of that, because you haven't actually started at the beginning. One of my particular pet peeves that sort of falls in line with this, that I really want to encourage you to take away from this session, if you take away nothing else, is that acronyms are a bad thing. If you're describing your congregation or your program using an acronym, what you're effectively doing is speaking insights. You know, that's great at committee meeting or a board meeting where everybody who's there is an insight. But when you meet somebody who knows nothing about what you do and you're trying to bring them in and you're using an acronym, you're not bringing them in, you're building a wall. So please don't use that acronym. The other thing that I think is particularly troubling for a lot of people these days is that, you know, 10 years ago there were three ways you had to communicate with your members or your donors or your constituents. You mailed them, you called them on the phone, you saw them face to face. But these days, communication just looks more like this. I mean, this is honestly even a fraction of what's out there, right? So there are all these channels and tools. I was talking to somebody at lunch about this who said that they had gone to a session, not here, someplace else, where somebody had said to them, you know, it doesn't matter, you should just be using Twitter, you should just tweet, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, misspelled, it does, you know, you just need to be out there. You know, I really disagree with that. I think it's really important for you to be clear who your target audience is, who you want to reach, and what often are you trying to achieve with them? Are you trying to deepen a relationship with a congregant? Are you trying to engage somebody and bring them into the community in a new way? Are you trying to get somebody to support you financially or sign a petition? So if you're clear who you want to reach and what you want to achieve, then you pick the way you communicate in a very targeted way, in a very selective way. And there is never going to be enough time in your day to do all of these things. So I would encourage you to not just jump on the what people tell me I should be doing now. Where you get most bang for your buck, given the limited amount of time you have in a day to communicate. So it's kind of like paddling across a sea, right? This vast sea of communications. And so how do we do that? Let's talk turkey. I would propose that you, whether you have lost touch with this feeling or not, are a nonprofit superhero. When I showed my husband this slide deck, he was like, don't you think Superman's a little Goya-ish? So I'm going to give you four practices that are really marketing principles and practices. I assume most of you don't have degrees in marketing, so this hopefully will be new for you, and if you do have a degree in marketing, maybe it'll be a refresher. So the four concepts I'm going to talk about right now are taking the long view, positioning and personality, being audience-centric, and being consistent. So we'll take these four things apart, and then I'll show you a case study. Okay, so taking the long view. You know, when you start your job, and I think there's even a book called The First 90 Days. You start your job and you have this kind of wide open landscape. You have perspective, you have clarity. But as you get into your job, and as you get mired in the nitty-gritty of what has to happen every day, it can be very easy to lose sight of the bigger picture. And so we tend to spend most of our time focused on what I need to get done today and getting out of touch with what's happening in the world around us. So the long view is really just about remembering to stop and take a step back. Being actually here at the assembly, at this convention, is a long view practice because you've taken time out of your day or your week to come here and connect with other people, find out what your peers are doing. Looking at the websites of other congregations in your community or other congregations in the country is a long view practice. Reading trade publications is a long view practice. And keeping an eye on trends that are happening is a long view practice. And I would encourage you to try to build that time proactively into your planning life so that you don't find that one day you wake up with the, oh my goodness, I didn't see Facebook coming conversation happening. That you're proactively identifying these things the way when you are flying an airplane and you look down and you see these beautiful fields and you have this perspective and the luxury of a little bit of time, maybe a day, a quarter, just to think about it. And then you can take those things you identify and you can bring them down to a more practical level where you start to budget for things, plan for things. You know, I have a colleague at Big Duck, Doug Farah Charpeter, who does a lot of speaking about web development. One of the things Farah says is, with the pace of technology changing, most organizations are finding they need to radically overhaul their websites every 2 or 3 years. Just because the technology is moving so quickly and the things we expect our websites to be able to do is changing so rapidly. I mean, 2 or 3 years ago, who would have thought we would be talking about Twitter or Facebook in a forum like this? But we are. So if you know that 2 or 3 years from now you might be overcrowding your website, start budgeting for it now, start anticipating now, so you know it's coming. And that way, when you spend most of your time, which you will, in the trenches, you have some connection to the outside world. The second concept I want to talk about, and this is really two concepts rolled into one, but it's positioning and personality, which you try to do marketing practices that the for-profit world has been using since the dawn of time, but we in the nonprofit sector are just kind of getting wise to them. And in my book, I've talked a lot about how to adapt them for nonprofit contexts. This is really about having a strategy for what you're trying to communicate before you start communicating. Okay, so the brand raising model, which I'll be talking about a little bit more in my workshop after this, is built on the idea that as a nonprofit, Okay, so any organization that goes through strategic planning typically has a defined vision, mission, values, objectives, and audiences. I mean, I would argue that all of our organizations have those things. It's a question of whether you formally stated them or not, right? Positioning and personality are marketing concepts. We'll talk about those more in a minute. The next layer of brand raising is the stuff that most people think of when they think of branding, your visual identity, which is not just your logo, but the colors you use, the typography you use, and your messaging platform. Anybody want to throw up one thing you think might be in the messaging platform? Can you not read it? You know, I was trying to get it sharper, and the projector quality is not great. Sorry about that. Maybe in the next workshop we'll have a better projector. Anybody want to throw out anything about the messaging platform? Any guesses? Yeah.
Bulletin.
A bulletin might be that. A bulletin is really an imprint tool, right? It's a piece you use every day or every week or every month to get the word out. But the content in that bulletin, you know, is your messaging, right? The name of your organization. If you have a tagline, the big things you say over and over again, that's your messaging platform. And then the experiential level, which is this bottom, these are the channels and tools you use to communicate. So you communicate, is that better? Does that help? Oh, good, okay. As long as there's no mapping. You express these things through online communications in print, on air, in person, and actually more and more nonprofits are using cell phones to do advocacy work and to fundraise. So let's take a closer look at positioning and personality. Positioning is the big idea you want people to think of when they think of your organization. The big idea we want people to think of when they think of your organization. And I don't just mean what they think after they have a conversation with you and you walk away. I mean, immediately, what do they remember when they think about you? A month later, what do they remember when they think about you? When they're talking about your work over the dinner table, how are they describing you as somebody who knows nothing about your congregation? And I think a key part of that is what makes you different, right? Particularly if you're operating in a place where there are a lot of other similar types of organizations. What defines you uniquely at a very local level or even at a regional or national level? So let's look at an example. Anybody ever heard of Red Cross? Yeah? What do you think of when you think of Red Cross? What do they do?
Disaster
relief. Anything else you think of when you think of Red Cross?
Blood
donations. Right? I mean, the Red Cross has done a terrific job establishing these pretty simple ideas in our minds. Now, we all know the Red Cross is probably exponentially larger than most of our organizations, with a lot more money to communicate than most of us will ever have to spend in our lives. But what do? They hammer home a couple of really simple ideas over and over and over again. If you visit their website, if you hear about them on the news, if you read about them, you get a brochure. Everything they do ladders up to this idea of we are the disaster relief organization. So what do we want people to think of when they think of your organization? Personality is the other piece of your communication strategy. And this is really the tone and style with which, not with which you communicate currently, but the way you want to communicate. Anybody ever see this ad? Yeah, so who's in this ad, which is a Mac commercial, what's this guy like? The guy on the right.
Can you go back to that previous slide?
Sure. Yeah. Sorry. The overarching feeling thing you want people to associate with your organization. Another thing I would say about personality is this is sort of like the taste in the mouth that somebody ends up having after they met you, right? What lingers for them? Okay, so tell me about the Mac. This guy who uses the Mac, the Mac gets. What's he like?
Cool.
Loose. What else?
Smart.
Confident.
Innovative.
And expensive. Yes, indeed. And how about PC? What's he like?
Nerdy.
Boring.
Slow.
Stuffy. He's like a hang of times, right? And so he's this bumbling buffoon. Is that what Mac has done is they've chosen these actors and written the script to personify the personality of businesses that they want you to believe. So, you know, one way to think about this is if you were casting a movie about your shoe's life, who would play your shoe? Right? Think about that, because it says a lot about the personality of your organization and what they want to communicate. And I think it's a particularly interesting and maybe challenging question these days when most, at least in my world, most of the Jewish organizations I work with are struggling between this sort of dichotomy of wanting to keep older members or constituents engaged and you know, finding relevant content, and at the same time attracting people in their 20s or 30s who communicate very differently and might have a much more casual, informal way of thinking. So let's look at a couple of examples in the nonprofit space. Everybody reasonably familiar with these organizations? Yeah? What do they have in common?
Animals.
Right. So probably we could agree that all three of these organizations are trying to fight against the animals. But when you think about, you know, the way that the ASPCA or the Humane Society or PETA communicates, it's very different. What they do programmatically is very different. But even the tone and style with which they communicate is very different. And, you know, maybe one way to describe it would be that the ASPCA is very warm and fuzzy. You get a lot of emails of cats and kittens. In fact, they segment their emails. If they know you're a cat person, you only get cat messages. If they know you're a dog person, you get dog stuff. Whereas the Humane Society is much more grassroots. They want you to go out and make a video about why dog fighting is bad and post it on YouTube. And a lot of their stuff promotes that. And then PETA is pretty well known for their controversial stuff. So depending on how you feel about that, you might feel like they're radical or out there, or you might think they're right. But I think most people would agree they're edgy. So this is an example of how the personality with which you communicate has a really big impact on how people feel about you. If you as a donor wanted to support one of these causes, it might actually, the personality of these organizations might be the thing you use to decide who to support. Okay, so before we go on to this third principle, which is being audience-centric, I just want to pause and say that I think one of the reasons positioning and personality are important to define is not just because it's fun to do, but because once you've defined that big idea you want people to think of when they think of your organization and the tone and style with which you communicate, then everything you do starts to have focus as you're communicating. Every speech you write, every press release you write, every newsletter article, every website you build or design, you can vet against positioning and personality. You can say, does this tweet express your personality? Well, does Twitter fit in with our personality? Is it appropriate for us to be using? Or does this new website design that you know a volunteer has developed reflect the tone and style we want to communicate? And it's very helpful to have that because it takes the conversation away from the subjective. We're no longer having a conversation where we're saying, ooh, I like the website, ooh, it's pretty. We're starting to say, okay, does this website really reflect what we want it to? Yeah.
Could you, somewhere during the course of this session, help us think through, you know, one of the things about our movement and about conservative rabbis is that we have a very complex story and message. And I think it's hard for most of us to sort of start to not give up our pride and love,
right?
Complexity, and yet think this way.
Could people get over here? Julie's question.
Yeah, no, what I was saying was that I observe among our colleagues that we have a very complex
right? You're so close to the nuances of it, and there might be 18 different parts. And for you to say which ones of those 18 different parts should be in front of or prioritized over others is much harder than it might be for an external person. But actually, your question is a very good segue into the idea of being audience-centric, because I think one of the inherent problems with the way most organizations communicate is they communicate too much from their own point of view about what they have to say, and not enough from the point of view of what they have to offer their audiences. So if you switch the conversation to be less about us and more about them and what we give them, it can sometimes start to solve that question. So let's keep going with this and we'll come back to that, I think. So first I want to show you some examples of what audience-centric is not, or the opposite of audience-centric, which is being organization-centric. I'm a native New Yorker and I take the subway a lot, and I like to take a lot of pictures on the subway. So you may recognize some of these if you're New York City subway riders. So this is an ad that the New York Times has been running. We don't just cover it, we are it. I mean, it's an interesting ad, but it tells me, the reader, nothing about why I should read the New York Times. Right? I mean, I have to, what this ad does is it reinforces the New York Times brand as sort of, you know, the king of the New York newspaper scene, perhaps. But it's kind of, you know, all about that, right? What do I get out of it? And, you know, another example, this is a screenshot I took from JP Morgan's website. I thought this was really interesting. They say on their website, our aim is to be the world's most trusted and respected financial services institution. You know, well, good for you, but why should I trust you with my money? Right? So, you know, if your messaging, if your website is talking about your goals, what's in it for people visiting the website? Why should they care? So what being audience-centric is about is really putting yourself in their shoes and understanding where they're coming from. You know, somebody I was talking to at lunch was talking about in a session on data, on gathering data. And I think particularly if you're in a smaller community, you don't even have to do this kind of scientifically or with a lot of surveys. A lot of it's just about talking to people and really understanding what makes them tick. For instance, you know, who are they and what else is going on in their life besides their connection to you? What else are they passionate about? What role does your organization play in their big world? You know, I think another challenge we sometimes have as communicators in the nonprofit world is that because what we're saying is really important to us, we assume it's really important to them, and most of the time it's just not. You know, does anybody want to guess how many marketing messages the average American gets in a typical day?
100.
100?
What was that?
1,500.
In the 80s, there were a couple of studies about this, and in the 80s, the studies suggested that the average American was receiving roughly 5,000 marketing messages a day. I would argue that today, with all the different streams of communication that come at us, and all the ads we see, even in places like Google Mail, that we are actually, each of us individually, filtering out and ignoring probably upwards of 10,000 messages a day. So what that means is your messages, even if you're communicating to people who should really care, are still getting sent to people who are inundated with stuff, just as we're all inundated with stuff. And we're all in the business of ignoring, every one of us. If we didn't ignore the vast majority of messages we get every day, we would never get out of our pajamas in the morning. You can't possibly pay attention to everything. So I think it's really important to remember who you're trying to communicate with and where your communications fit in to their world. And one of the great things about technology is that if you're able to use it, it's now pretty cost-effective to start to message to people in much more customized ways. And it's sort of an ironic thing, because I remember 10 years ago working with nonprofits, there was a lot of, if we could only figure out a way to send emails to the people, you know, the families with little kids that, you know, where they got stuff that was about the kids' stuff, but the other people that didn't have little kids didn't have to get those messages. We would say, oh, that technology would be great. Well, now that technology is free, it's here. The problem is we don't have the bandwidth to use it correctly. You guys don't have the time to write one email for families with young kids and another email for other people. But being mindful of where people are coming from, the amount of messages they're filtering out is really key. So let's look at some an example of businesses that are audience-centric, that get this idea. Anybody ever run? Anybody run? Yeah, so a handful of people. I started running about 2-3 years ago. I run, like most people can outwalk me, run. But boy, when I started running, did this message start to make sense to me. I mean, every day when I get up in the morning and I know I should go out for that run, I'm like, oh, okay, just do it. That's what I have to do. This is not a just do it and buy our t-shirts, or just do it and we'll give you X, right? It's called action for you, for the target audience. And Nike knows how hard it is for somebody who's trying to exercise and run to go out and do it. So they're speaking to that. Anybody ever seen these ads? Dr. Zizmore. So for those of you who don't live in the New York area, that sounds like most of you see these. Dr. Zizmore is this dermatologist in New York. And about 14, 15 years ago, he started running these ads on the subway. And these ads, I think it's fair to say that these ads are just terrible. Right? They're kind of tacky and awful, and you can see, here's Dr. Zizmore, and there's all these little, you know, rainbows and stars and things. And here's a detail of part of it, right? Now, the New Yorker wrote an article a couple of years ago about Dr. Zizmore, and one of the things they talked about was the fact that these ads have been wildly successful for this guy. He's built probably the biggest dermatological practice in New York City because of these ads. What these ads do is they speak to his target audience, which is the average, you know, probably low-income New Yorker who's riding the subway, who wants to feel beautiful, and they speak the audience's language. Right? He's not speaking like some high-level fancy guy. He's speaking like somebody who understands that I need great treatment when I need it cheap. And he's telling me all the things he can do, and he's making it easy, he's giving me a phone number, he's even telling me I'm going to be approved, and I might come out looking like this chick. These ads are wildly successful because they're audience-centered. This is an ad on the subway for the Institute for Practical Philosophy, which I also think is a nice example. It says, this poster can make you happier than any other on the subway. So that invites me in, right? I want to read what's next. A lot more effective than a headline that says, come to our important class next Thursday about Buddhism. Okay, so let's look at some websites in a faith-based world. I think one of the most interesting exercises you can do if you're rethinking the way you communicate, perhaps with board members or other people on your staff, is to poke around some other people's websites. Maybe do this, you know, in a conference room with a bunch of people and talk about what you find. Talk about what they're doing that you think is working, that you could learn from, and what they're doing that maybe you disagree with. So I had somebody in my office pick three websites from three faith-based organizations in New York City, fairly randomly. So the first one is Congregation Beth Elohim. Anybody know these guys? They're in my neighborhood, and Andy Bachman, who's the rabbi there, is causing quite a stir. I've got this quote that Newsweek just called this one of America's 25 most vibrant congregations, and talked about how they're quickly adapting to Brooklyn's exciting young population. But, you know, when you look at this website, what I think is interesting to note is it's very dynamic, right? It looks pretty young. And there's a lot of action we can take. I can join easily with, you know, one click away from finding out how I join. I'm, you know, given the opportunity to search, to sign up for news. There's upcoming events all over the place, special events. These things rotate. There's video. Right, so there's a lot of pretty dynamic content given to me on the homepage, and I would guess that for the vast majority of people who are visiting this website, what they're looking for is right there. It's right on top. This is a website for the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue, which we thought was interesting for a couple of reasons I wanted to flag for you. First, I do love the Hamantash Bake Off. But look at this, Next Service Live, and what they're doing here is they're counting down the minutes until they post their next service on the website. So apparently, I would imagine from that maybe they have a pretty active group of people who want to watch their services online. They've got an events calendar, what they say, there's a lot of stuff going on here. So again, understanding what people want, giving it to them online. And then another interesting example is The River. Has anybody seen this organization? This is a non-denominational church that was started in Lower Manhattan a few years ago. And they have been marketing up the storm. What I think is very interesting about the way they market is that they don't tell you, they ask questions. Asking questions is a great way to be audience-centric. So I don't know if you guys can read this, but so this is one of their questions is, could church help? Or skeptical but curious about faith. And they actually made a series of videos. You don't see them on this page, but if you poke around their website, you'll see them, where there are people really asking questions about faith and what kind of role it might make in somebody's lives individually, in a family's life, in a community's life. Okay, so I'm going to keep going and move on to consistency, but let me just pause for a second. I think we've got time. Anybody have any questions about any of this so far? Yeah.
So the audience-centric piece, what if part of the message of the institution is that you don't think it's good to be audience-centric? You know, it's sort of the message itself is contrapuntal with the idea that everything is tailored to the audience.
Well, I don't think everything has to be tailored to the audience. I think everyone has to be reinvent what you do to be whatever they want to be. I think what it means is you build a conversation that starts with where they are, not with where you are. Right? So if you're over here and they're over there, the best way to get here is actually for you to walk over there and say, I know that you think these things, or at least, this is your overview. Let me take you on a journey with you. This is one of the reasons storytelling is so effective. Right? If we share a meaningful story, what we're really doing is bringing something on the journey to help them come along to where we want them to end up. So what being audience-centric means isn't necessarily that the work you're doing is different. It's the way you engage people in the work, the way you start the conversation. Yeah?
My question is about our culture's screen centricity, right? Like your talk right now, we're all glued to the screen.
Right.
And it's all about how glued to the screen we are as a culture. So we all have to do what you're doing without the screen.
Right.
Like Shabbat and holidays, our biggest audiences are there, and it's all just you.
FaceTime.
Right? So what do you have to, how do we be audience-centric when the media really is everyone wants to be, like, tweeting, twitting,
right,
under their screen? Probably, I joke, if we could do our high holiday services, and give everyone a laptop to watch, even if it's not there, they'd be much more engaged than where we all do screen, right?
Right. Yeah, so that's a great question. There's a book that's on my reading list. I haven't read it yet, but I've been hearing interesting things called Alone Together. Has anybody read this book? Alone Together is written by a psychologist, and it's about this phenomenon where we're all in the same room, or we're in the same cafe, but we're all actually engaged with our own laptops, or through our screens, or Facebook pages. We're alone together. And it talks a bit about the psychology of that. But to address your question, I think one of the most tried and true audience-centered practices when you're speaking is to ask questions, to get people talking, to engage. Now, that's not so easy to do on a Saturday morning, per se. But there may be other ways to do that. There may be other ways to build that conversation. And I think another big issue is about time, right? How much time you have to hold people's attention. And I think part of what's embedded in what you're saying is that people's attention spans are getting shorter. Sometimes less is more. The way we write for the web is very different than the way we were taught to write in school, where we were taught to lay out a thesis and then make points and then conclude it. Whereas in communicating on the web, writing for the web is much more like say what you have to say very quickly in a paragraph and get out. And I think that maybe that's increasingly the model for keeping people engaged as you speak to them. Now, this is, as I'm saying this, I feel like you have to definitely take this with a serious grain of thought, with salt, if you are, in a religious context or a spiritual context. And I think the question I would be asking if I were in your shoes is, how can I create an environment where meaningful spiritual things happen that I facilitate without, how do I spark internal conversation in this kind of external conversation? Yeah.
We recently had an amazing example of that whole point about are you assuming that people know something but they don't. So someone showed up at 5:30, non-Jews, on a Friday, saying, we came to see the candle lighting. Because they looked at our website and said, candle lighting. and that happened. We really did look at our website and try to get rid of, translate everything that's written out, translate the great people, translate, and what if the person had never been to the synagogue? And even so, he just,
wow.
Even better example is just you listen to the time the services begin and only the Gentiles show up.
Okay, so let's talk about the fourth concept, which is consistency, and then I'm going to take you through an example. Anybody recognize this? What is this? It's a Tiffany box. It says Tiffany on it, but even if you couldn't, you can't really read the type, right? You probably knew it was a Tiffany box. Do you know that, Tiffany, which I don't know how long Tiffany's been around, but it's been around for a while. They've been using this box for a long time. Apparently, if you go to work at Tiffany, you would even have to get trained on how to tie a ribbon on the box. There's just a way to tie a ribbon. It's always a white ribbon, and it's always in the blue box. You never see Tiffany putting out, a pink box because it's Valentine's Day, right? But most nonprofits never learn this lesson. One of the things we do at Big Duck when we're working with an organization for the first time at Grand Design Work is we ask them to send us examples of all their stuff. You can do this. It's a really easy exercise. You get all the printed stuff together, maybe print out some stuff online, you lay it all out on tape. So what you're looking at here is all materials from one organization that they produced over about a year, year and a half. Now, it's pretty easy to see that this stuff is kind of a mess. Right? Individual pieces might be nice, but you would never connect the dots if you were the audience. You'd never realize that all this stuff from this event relates in any way to, the other stuff. And part of the reason that happens is because in most organizations, there isn't one central person who's kind of policing communications, vetting it, making sure it's consistent. It's also the case that most organizations don't take the time out to, just the way you have to take time out if you do strategic planning, you have to take time out to fix the brand, right? So fixing the brand takes time and money, and then you've got to enforce it consistently. But doing so means things really hold together, and it actually gets much easier to communicate later. And it's not rocket science. I've seen some really, really highly effective communicating organizations with no communications people on staff, no budget, just doing it with, with volunteers, with staff people. And really going for less is more. And what I tell those organizations is, don't give the gala or fundraising event its own logo. Why does it need its own logo? It's a fundraiser for your organization. Use your organization's logo. Reinforce your messages. Don't have new people who come in to attend that event bond with the event and not bond with the organization. Right? You want them to imprint on you. So sometimes it's sort of better to just, set up a basic platform and use that platform over and over and over again.
Can you speak a little bit to why that's necessarily a bad thing that they did? I mean, I understand consistency and so forth, but on the other hand, a lot of us have a variety of constituencies within our organization.
Right.
Not necessarily going to produce the same material for the nursery school families as you will for the elderly, etc. So maybe some of this is targeted.
Some of it may be, but oftentimes, I think a good question to ask yourself before you create a new identity or a new brand is the audience I'm trying to reach with this new initiative really that different from the core audience? If you're creating materials that you're going to give out to three-year-olds during, like a Tat Shabbat, then those things obviously have to be super kid-friendly and might be very different from what, the adults upstairs are getting. But most of the time, the audience for program A is the same as the audience for program B, or the people you want to have attend that fundraising event are the people you're going to hope come in for services. So the downside of doing this is, first of all, you're spending a lot more time and money designing it. Every time you sit down to create something new, somebody is thinking about it, spending time and energy figuring out what color should we use, what logo should we use, right? That's an investment of resources that you don't necessarily need. But I think the bigger issue is that on the receiving end,
If these materials are designed to get people from the outside to get more engaged, or people who are less engaged to become more engaged, you're not necessarily giving them reasons to do that. If they come to an event and they love that event and they see that event's logo, they might look out for that event's logo next year, but are they actually going to realize that the thing they got from the organization next month is related? It's part of the same universe of stuff. Yeah, and then we're going to keep going. Yeah.
I have a question on logos. I've noticed a lot of city guide logos and stationery. It's either pictures of a building or if you're art. It's art, it's not art. I've noticed a lot of JCCs and it's usually people somewhere in the logo.
Yeah.
Do you think this makes any difference?
You know, I think that it's extremely hard, and we've rebranded two shuls. It's extremely hard when you do that, when you're designing a logo, to avoid the obvious. And I think the challenge when you use something that is obvious, like a building or an arc, you know, or Hanukkah, that's another big one, is to try to find a way to make it fresh and original. So I think a lot of it comes down to the execution. That's a brief answer. We could talk more about that later if you like. Okay, so everybody here familiar with JetBlue? Anybody here fly out on JetBlue? Yeah, some of you did. You know, JetBlue is an interesting example in both consistency and audience centricity in that they understand that their brand and the way they communicate is not just this logo. In fact, most of us probably don't care about this logo, right? There are other things we associate with JetBlue, and they're very consistent about communicating those. What do you associate with JetBlue?
No frills.
No frills. Individual what?
Blue chips.
Blue chips. TVs. Right. These kinds of things.
Nonstop.
So, you know, JetBlue has done some interesting things in the way they communicate. And part of what they try to do is make us feel they are of us. Right. So if you look at these ads, they say things like, you know, not a tagline, a promise, or someone has to stand up for tall people. They're an airline, but they're positioning themselves almost as if they're advocates for the common traveler, you know. But they also don't just use their logo. They have this kind of visual identity system that they use very consistently. The way they use type, the way they use color is very consistent. Anybody ever been in Terminal 5 in JFK, the new JetBlue terminal? You know, this whole terminal reflects the brand, even down to the point there's this, you know, more legroom than the other guys thing that's spinning around. Everything is blue, there's free Wi-Fi. It's all about reinforcing their personality and their positioning. I'm going to keep going in the interest of time, but maybe we'll... Yes. So consistency. One of the things I hope you will take out of this session, if nothing else, is that sometimes it's better to use the same stuff you've been using for years and years and years and be consistent with it than create something new, unless you're confident that what you're creating new is being created for a really good reason, that it's being done strategically and thoughtfully. Save your money, save your time. Build, reinforce the brand you have. If you've been doing this for a while, chances are there's equity in that brand. Why not build on it? And if you're not sure, or you're not sure you're so strategic about your communications, then don't just, you know, create new stuff randomly. Think about that. Develop a strategy. Start with positioning and personality, and then make systematic changes. So let's look at an example. And I want to also emphasize that at 3:15, I'm going to be doing more of this stuff with more tangible how you do it kind of stuff. So this is the long view, and we're going to get into the nitty-gritty in that session. Okay, so has anybody ever heard of Masa Israel Journey? In this crowd? That's good to hear. So Masa Israel Journey is an organization that's now about 6 years old. It's a joint venture of the Jewish Agency for Israel and the State of Israel. And what Masa Israel Journey wants to do is they want to connect 18 to 29-year-olds with long-term programs in Israel. They want to help young people find the right program and in many cases subsidize their going to Israel for a big chunk of time. And so what I'm going to show you is the process that they went through when they went through the brand raising process. Their vision is to envision a world in which all Jews have deep personal connection to Israel and Jewish life. I mean, you know, this is a common vision for a lot of organizations in the Jewish world. But the mission is their slice of the pie. And in their case, the mission talks tangibly about what they do. And I'm a big advocate for formalizing your vision and your mission and your value statements. I think even the exercise of doing that internally is very clarifying, brings up a lot of good conversation. But vision and mission are different from positioning for several reasons. One reason positioning is different is it's internal. We might not share our positioning publicly. For instance, your positioning might be to be the leading conservative shul in the tri-state area. You wouldn't want to say that publicly. But it might be your goal. It might be what you want people to think of when they think of you. In Masal's case, their positioning is to make it easy. Making it easy is really the operative term to connect with these programs, and that those programs in turn create a lifelong sense of Jewish peoplehood. And the personality that emerged through the research that was conducted looks like this. Now, probably there are some adjectives here that you would agree your organization's personality should also embrace. But then there are other ones like fresh or cool that are somewhat unique to them. And actually, I think it was an interesting thing to go through this exercise because the State of Israel and Jaffe, you wouldn't expect those organizations to say, let's be fresh and cool, per se, because they're older, more established organizations who reach a broad range of people. But Maasai Israel is trying to reach a very specific group, and this is the personality they want that group to associate with them. So, does anybody here have key messages? Does your organization have key messages? No? Okay, so let's talk about this for a minute. So if you have this big idea you want to establish in people's minds, in order to get it in their minds, you have to repeat certain ideas over and over again that reinforce it. Right? Like, for instance, I can say to you that my company is the leading communications firm that works exclusively with nonprofits. But it's only when I talk to you over a period of time and you see me say certain things or do certain things that you actually believe that that's who we are. Because I'm reinforcing through key messages the big idea I want you to think when you think of my organization. So in Masa Israel's case, as they are trying to recruit young people to go on programs, what we found is that there are basically three questions that they need to help their audiences answer. Why go to Israel, why you should go, and why you should go through Masa Israel. Right, so one way to think about this is to ask yourself, if you're trying to build your membership base, what are the questions I need to answer to help people engage with me? And this is the same, also come back to your question. Right, so if somebody is debating whether or not to come to this conference, or debating whether or not to join the rhythm assembly, what are the questions you need to answer to help them understand the value for them? And then lastly, there is a message at the bottom supporting Masa Israel. It's always important to remember that you're not just recruiting members, you're also hopefully building relationships with maybe corporate supporters in the community, peer organizations, maybe federations, MLs, etc. So what are the messages you want to communicate to those people? You can then take your key messages and translate it into boilerplate copy. So these are three paragraphs of copy. Basically, we're going to roll all the key messages up into boilerplate copy. So when this organization is writing a grant or developing a brochure or doing anything, they don't have to start with a blank piece of paper. They can lift this and put it on something, which saves a lot of time. Another piece you can do is an elevator pitch. I've seen, has anybody ever tried to come up with an elevator pitch before? Yeah, so a couple of you. In my experience, organizations that sort of sit down and say, let's write the elevator pitch and we'll get everybody to memorize it, doesn't go very well. Is that the case? Yeah, it didn't go very well. The reason it doesn't go very well when you start there is there's no strategy. Right? So if you start the conversation with, at the end of the conversation, what do we want to leave these people with? What's the big idea we want them to be left with? What do we want them to feel or think about us? And then you start to craft the elevator pitch, it's a lot easier to do. So I would argue that it's actually a reductive process. You start with the positioning, that big idea. You come up with the 3 to 5 messaging points you need to communicate in order to get there. Then you take those points and you boil it down to 1 to 3 sentences, and that's your elevator pitch. So you don't start writing an elevator pitch. You wring the elevator pitch out of the process. If it's up to me, every organization has its full staff, its full board, anybody who's deeply engaged, memorize this and repeat it verbatim. And then another really effective tool in your communications arsenal can be a style guide. Now, if you're a small shul and you're operating with not a lot of staff, it may seem like overkill to put it all into a guide. But the value of putting it into a guide is you're creating institutional memory, right? So that when the people who work on this stuff leave or committees change, there's something written down in paper that can be used consistently. And the whole point of all of this is not to start with a blank piece of paper every time you communicate. So from Masai Israel, here's a little bit how it looks. A program brochure starts to look a lot like a letterhead. This is a website that was developed. Now, I should mention that this is a website that my company built, but this is a website that volunteered for that. Right? See how related they feel? If you were visiting this website, which is the sort of public-facing website, it's actually going live in a couple of months, and then you visited this website, which is a sort of private community for people who've been on these programs, you wouldn't feel that they were so different. You would feel that they were very consistent, right? And that's because this organization has the tools they need to make sure that everything is seen from the same songbook.
Colors are the same.
Logos relate. The design devices are similar. And all that's in the style guide. So this is an ad campaign they're about to start running. And even in this ad campaign, even though there's kind of a new theme and new visuals, you still see reinforced here and in this copy, which you probably can't read, their key messages, their logo, their big ideas. And then as that campaign gets translated online, this is what an email is. So really what it's about is creating a vocabulary of pieces and just using those pieces over and over and over again. Sometimes just when you are so sick of looking at that logo or saying that elevator pitch or whatever, that's when it's actually starting to work. That's when it takes root. Because you're close to it, right? If you're doing your job well, you're supporting it and using this stuff all the time. But the people on the receiving end, this is one of those thousands of messages that I get every day. They need to see and hear those same messages over and over again to pay attention. Okay, so we talked about four principles today: the long view, positioning and personality, being audience-centric, and being consistent. If you want to measure how your organization is doing, somebody on my staff created a free tool that's on our website where you can go in and take a survey, basically, and assess your own brand. At the end of completing the survey, it generates a report, and you can print it out, and it'll give you sort of a high-level sense of how you're doing. One of the interesting exercises people have been doing with this is if you're debating whether or not to do some branding work, but you're not sure, maybe there's disagreement at a board or committee level, have five or six different people all complete this, all print out the reports, get together and talk about it. So this is the URL. Because I'm standing in front of you, I can shamelessly plug my workshop at 3:15 in Marquee 2, and I'll also be after that signing some books over there. This is what the book looks like. It's on Amazon.
It's on Kindle.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Yay! And you can find me in all the obvious places. So we have 1 minute. Plugged our resources. So what she's talking about is a monthly e-news called .com, which you can sign up for on our website, www.nyc.com. We also have a blog. We blog out about nonprofit communications, and a lot of things if you want more. Okay, you might have time for one question, but then you can cut the break. Yeah.
You tend to work with lay leaders or professionals in shaping the modes of communication.
That's a great question. You work with lay leaders or professionals when shaping the modes of communication. The organizations that we work with at Big Duck tend to be larger organizations, and oftentimes we are working with committees, and those committees have a combination of staff and lay leadership. But I would probably argue that that's a good practice anyway in
because one of the big reasons nonprofits are different than for-profits is that most of the people who are engaged for sort of passionate personal reasons. And if they don't feel they've been a part of the process, they don't buy into it, and then they fight it and they make your life difficult. So oftentimes when we're doing our work, we not only interview the people we need to interview because they're important, we interview the people who are going to be problems if they don't get interviewed. Right? So my advice is that you design a process, however you do this, that you design a process where you think consciously about who needs to be involved for the work to be successful and where's the best place to involve them. What I think is not effective is when you form a committee of 20 people and every decision is made by every committee, but I suspect I don't need to tell you that. So I wrote a piece actually a few years ago for the DuckCon that is on our website called Great Creative by Committee, and it's all about how you decide who should be involved where in the process. But it is a dilemma, and it's one of the reasons that doing work in the nonprofit sector is slower and harder, because you can't just do it all yourself and roll it out and be done the way, you know, the CEO of for-profit sometimes. Okay, so we're going to take a break. I'm going to answer questions.